and whatever else suited you here that's on our table. We'd like to have a few moments here of getting acquainted with some of our friends from Chosen People Ministries and Joel Rosenberg. So I'm going to ask our two CPM folks to come join us here at the front table, Mitch Glazer and Michael Zinn, and Joel, if you'll join us here as well. Good to hear.
I want to put the B back in the bio, right? Not back into it, but consistent with it.
If I could interrupt your conversations, let me introduce our guests here this morning. First of all, at the middle of the table, Dr. Mitch Glazer. Mitch is president of Chosen People Ministries. We'll ask him to describe a bit of the work that he does for CPM in just a moment. Sitting on this side of Mitch, and on your right, is Michael Zinn. Michael is executive director of Chosen People Ministries in Israel, and here with us for this week. Delight to have him here as well. And then Joel Rosenberg, who is known to many of you because of his very, very well-done books, novels. He's a New York Times award-winning, best-selling author. Joel, good to have you here as well. I'm going to ask each of you to tell us a bit about your role, what you do in the work that God has called you to be a part of. Mitch, let's begin with you as head of Chosen People Ministries.
Well, it's my joy to be able to lead Chosen People Ministries. Just a little bit of background, maybe. Chosen People was founded in 1894. And the way Chosen People was founded is in 1892. Leopold Kohn, a rabbi from Hungary, came to the United States, and he was interested in spiritual things, interested in Jesus even a little bit, according to the tradition. But he heard a Polish Presbyterian missionary to the Jews, sponsored by Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City, preaching the gospel on the steps of a Reformed church in Lower Manhattan in Yiddish. And he was curious. And so it just so happens that this person had just gotten a shipment of Yiddish New Testaments from England that previous week. He gave Rabbi Kohn a copy of the New Testament. He read it and got really interested and dialogued with this man and eventually became a believer in Jesus. And then they shipped him off to Edinburgh to go to seminary. Now, I had the privilege with my wife, Sahava, of checking on his student records. So I actually did that. So I went to Edinburgh, and I got his student ID, but they couldn't give me his records. So they needed a signature. So
after 100 years.
He founded Chosen People in Brooklyn. Today we're in, I think, 14 or 15 countries and probably a dozen or more cities around the United States. Still doing exactly what Rabbi Kohn did, that is bringing the gospel to the Jewish people. And so my job is trying to coordinate things and help everything stay together. I spend a lot of my time, like many of you who do similar tasks, recruiting and training and mentoring and raising funds and doing all sorts of things. That's what I do as the leader of Chosen People. Now, what I really do I live in Brooklyn, and I minister in Manhattan, and I've had the joy of being able to serve the Lord among a Jewish community of almost 3 million Jewish people. And so I view myself as a missionary to the Jewish people, and that's what I spend my life doing. And recently we just had a debate, and Dr. Daryl Bach was our moderator, replacing the esteemed Dr. Greg Haig, because he had too many papers to grade or something. But we had Shmuley Boteach, an Orthodox rabbi, who just wrote a book called Kosher Jesus, which is a very unkosher Jesus. And Mike Brown, a Messianic Jewish apologist who wrote a book called The Real Kosher Jesus. And so we had a debate on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in the middle of a very strong Jewish neighborhood. And probably had somewhere between 500, 600, 700 people, I couldn't count. And we had well over 100 non-believing Jewish people. Had a half-page ad in the New York Times with the two of them, you know. And drew a lot of non-believers, and it was just a fantastic time. And that's the kind of thing that I love doing. And I like to be able to do creative things to lift up the name of Yeshua among Jewish people to make him as attractive as he is.
Thank you. Michael, tell us a bit about your ministry there in Israel, the Holy Land, despite what
Mitch
claims. Yeah.
Going back to the Gospels, when Jesus was baptized by John, no one actually asked, is it Jewish? Or his first followers, no one actually doubted, is it Jewish to believe in Messiah, Jesus? It was clear to everyone that it is. Unfortunately, the 2,000 years of development of Christian faith, we got completely different picture now in Israel. And Christianity is taken in Israel as everything but Jewish. So my role, and it's the way I see it, to show to Jewish people that believing in Yeshua or Jesus is Jewish, and it makes you super Jew, if you want, to believe in Jewish Messiah. Because if Yeshua is not Messiah for Jews, he's not Messiah to anyone. That's clear. Well, the main goal is to see Jewish people saved. That's the goal. That's the strategy. Tactically, we can do it by 1 million different ways, and we try to be really creative, and we see a lot of fruits, and we see the mission of us as threefold. One is congregational planting and proclaiming the gospel, or put it in different order, it doesn't really matter, and that's evangelism proper. Another venue is discipleship. One of the problems in Israel is you got a lot of people coming to faith every year, but really shortage of leaders. And if even you got the leaders, very committed leaders, the lack of educated or sound doctrine among Israeli believers. So that's to making disciples, and to make discipleship is very, very important. And the third venue is all sort of humanitarian work. Frankly, I see it not as humanitarian work, but as the part of the package of evangelism, because our life has to reflect the gospel, and loving people, supporting people, and helping people, comforting people is, of course, part of gospel sharing. I'm in Israel for 23 years already, and I can see huge growth in messianic movement, both in numbers and in quality. So that's the way we see our role, and our mission as Chosen People Ministry is by large is the biggest in all Israel, and I wish it will be our budget will be the same as we big, but that's you know we got great
think of the great testimony of doing so much with so little.
We do.
The other way of getting at it is we can lock the doors until you get what you need. Joel, tell us about the things that you do. You have written some riveting novels. Tell us a bit about that and some of what God has led you to be a part of as a result, partly as a result of that.
Sure, Dennis. Thank you so much. Well, let's start off with the facts that I am a failed political consultant. That's really my professional pedigree. I helped Steve Forbes on two presidential campaigns, lost about $75 million of his daughter's inheritance money, and worked for Prime Minister Netanyahu and his comeback campaign team of in the year 2000. As you know, it took him 9 years to come back. I didn't help him at all the second time around. I was an advisor to Natan Sharansky. He got so frustrated with politics, he retired. So of that illustrious career, I thought, okay, Lord, you know, maybe there's something else I could do with my life than helping people lose. So that's when I started just making things up for a living. And that's when I started writing fiction. Now, of course, all my friends said, weren't you writing fiction when you were working for Rush Limbaugh and for all these other people? And I was like, listen, yes, but now I'm admitting it. Okay. So I began writing political thrillers mainly because I couldn't do anything else. But I did have the passion to write on several different pieces. One, I enjoyed Clancy-type novels, and I wanted to write them in a way that I could read them, you know, less foul language and so forth. But I wanted to imagine what-if scenarios. What-if scenarios that said, what if certain end times Bible prophecies were to happen in my lifetime? I can't say that they necessarily will, but what if they did? What would that look like? What would that feel like? And how do I do that in a way that takes the prophecy and sort of backs it up? You know, prophecy, God gives us some fascinating insights into some things that are going to happen at some times of history in some places, but he doesn't give us enormous amounts of detail. So that's where fiction has a possibility, there's an opportunity to take that and be as theologically sound as possible, but back up the story and say, how could we get, one way, what's one scenario that we could get from where we are today to that point? The most intriguing of which to me is the prophecies of Ezekiel 36 through 39, obviously the rebirth of Israel, followed by Jews coming back and rebuilding the ancient ruins, and then the War of Gog and Magog scenario. So that intrigues me. My family, on my father's side, were Orthodox Jews that escaped out of Russia in the early part of the 1900s. So the convergence of the future of Russia, the future of Israel, future Bible prophecy, and heading towards a Romans 11:26 world where all of Israel will be saved, that convergence of events intrigued me. And so taking the political experience of now it's, 22 years or so, 23 years in Washington, and trying to make that book as plausible as you can, a series of books, but also weaving the gospel into it. One of my passions was how could I write a book that Netanyahu and Forbes and Limbaugh and other people that I'd worked for, or Sharansky, might read? How can I grab their attention and hold it? Because I had a hard time when I worked for them, hard time as in almost didn't have any opportunity to share the gospel directly with them. And so I was really praying about how, I don't want to stand in heaven one day and be in one line, saved by the grace of Yeshua, and have any of them or others be in another line, having never, and have them say, we paid you to advise us on all these different issues, and you never advise us on the most important issue. I didn't know how. I struggled. I tried. But the novels were a way. The one other piece, just I don't want to go on and on. We can see if there's interest in it and if there are questions. But as the novels became successful, and no one was more shocked than my wife, but she's very supportive, but we were just both like, wow. I mean, the first one became a New York Times bestseller for 11 weeks, number one on Amazon. I was interviewed on 160 radio and television shows in less than 60 days. And almost every single interview, at least on radio, they'd start off with, how did you see these things coming? And then, you know, this was the last jihad kamikaze attack on the United States. That's how it begins and leads to a war with Iraq. And then they'd say, now, wait a minute, your name is Rosenberg, right? Right. Well, that's Jewish, isn't it? Right. But you've got these characters at the end of your book, they're all talking about how to be saved by Jesus, aren't they? Yes. Well, what are you, a born again? An evangelical? None of them had ever heard the term messianic. And I don't use that myself because that's not the way I was raised in my own culture of evangelicalism. But long story short, it gave me a lot of opportunities to talk about how you can be Jewish and believe in Jesus, which I couldn't imagine that that's what they'd want to talk about. But somehow the book hooked people and began to, at least these radio show hosts, and caused them to want to talk about it. So as the books became successful, then the challenge was, okay, Lord, we know what's coming prophetically to Israel and to her neighbors, to the Palestinians, to the Iranians, to the Iraqis, it was over. I don't want to just write about them. I want to use this opportunity that you've given me, this platform, to leverage somehow people to be mobilized, Christians to be mobilized, to bless Israel and her neighbors in the name of Jesus. And so in a sense, what we did, just to sum it up in a paragraph, is we created something called the Joshua Fund, which we think of as a mutual fund. We go out and we meet ministries, leaders, we see projects that God is doing among Israelis, among Palestinians, in Iraq, and so forth. And we say, Lord, is there something that you would like us to do to invest in that work? CPM being part of that, a critical part of that. And that's what's been exciting for us, is to say, Lord, your heart is to reach every Jew and Gentile in the land of Israel with the gospel of Jesus Christ and have the gospel be spread through that region and from that region back to the Jews as a reverb effect. Is there some role that we can play in helping advance and strengthen the local ministries, the local church, to accomplish that mission? And could all the teaching and speaking on novels and at conferences and so forth somehow be part of that leveraging process? And that's where the Joshua Fund concept developed.
Thank you, Joel. It is uncanny how events that you write about actually do come to pass. Are you a prophet?
Oh, I run a nonprofit, and so no, I don't claim that role or position. But I am writing about prophecy, and I'm trying to. I don't want to say popularize it because I think that cheapens it, but I want to get people as intrigued as I am, or at least some degree of that, that we are living in such an extraordinary moment that when we talk about Iran's threat to annihilate the Jewish people and wipe Israel off the planet, the very fact that there is an Israel on the planet as a duly constituted Jewish state is so extraordinary, and we can forget that is the fulfillment of end times Bible prophecy. And I know that prophecy has been, a lot of people have shied away from studying or teaching it, in part because it has been sensationalized, in part because people have forgotten the power of it. But we are living right in the middle of it. And the fact that there are three Jewish people, among others, in this room who have woken up and smelled the Starbucks and said, oh my gosh, Jesus really is the Messiah, this is part of end times Bible prophecy. Again, we are heading towards a Romans 11:26 world. It's a long, very painful, bitter, difficult road to get to all of Israel be saved, but it's in motion. And the fact that it's in motion is so exciting. I think the church, broadly speaking, is missing just how exciting it really is, because for whatever reasons, either people don't really believe it's literally true, or again, it's been sensationalized and poorly taught, and therefore people said, look, they don't want to get associated with that or go and make those same mistakes. It's also complicated, so some people, pastors and teachers, just say, I don't understand it, I don't want to go there. But they're missing the magic, as it were, of the moment that Jesus is coming back and he's getting us ready. And I think particularly for young people who totally aren't getting this. I mean, that's why a conference like this is so important to me to get involved with, because helping not just the broader public, but young people in particular realize this is an extraordinary moment that we're in. Do you realize what you're involved with right now? because most aren't. And when they begin to get that, well, I think it changes their faith, the dynamic of living for Jesus with purity and with a desire to make impact in a way that, sometimes they hadn't been previously. Mm.
One of the little-known aspects of Biola's history is the close connection the school has had with the Jewish believers through the years, almost since the day Biola opened as the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. It goes back that far. The first dean of the Bible Institute was William Blackstone. William Blackstone is credited as being the founder of Christian Zionism. Very influential man throughout the world in drawing attention to the Jewish people and to the needs for establishing, reestablishing a nation in the Promised Land. And then it's been a variety of ways in which Biola has been involved, not the least of which currently is an involvement with Chosen People Ministries partnering for a program in Messianic Jewish Studies in Manhattan. Mitch, tell us a little about that.
Sure. You know, one of the comments I'd like to make, though, about Blackstone, he wrote a book called Jesus is Coming Again in the 1880s. And that book was really, really transformed a lot of the church. We always seem to think that the church at that time was all conscious of eschatology and what was happening. But you realize somebody in the 1880s was writing a book saying the Jewish people are going to come back to the land and settle there. You know, it's quite amazing that he did that. But the thing I like best about Blackstone, who was a good boy from Chicago, actually, and one of the things I liked about him was he also, on one hand, he believed in Christian education. On the other hand, he taught a lot about prophecy. And on the other hand, he started the Chicago Hebrew Mission. And so Blackstone was able to wed the two so well. Jesus is coming again. Therefore, we need to reach Jewish people with the gospel because we're headed to a Romans 11, 25 through 26 world. And his legacy lives on. That mission that he started is still still there and has had a lot of influence. I think the same has been true at Biola, probably started at the Church of the Open Door, which for years and years and years always had a Jewish ministry. And there was a time when a younger Dr. Charles Feinberg was brought in to be part of that ministry and rapidly began doing something else as he was quite the scholar. And Talbot was emerging as a graduate program of the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. And Dr. Feinberg became the first dean. Neat part about that is that, again, Church of the Open Door had a view of eschatology, a view in the future of Israel, but also a great concern about reaching Jewish people now, today. Dr. Feinberg, of course, is a Jewish believer. He came to the Lord through Chosen People Ministries, then called the American Board of Missions to the Jews. One of our missionaries, John Solomon, was going door to door in a Jewish Orthodox area in Pittsburgh, and he left the Feinberg family a Yiddish tract. And does everybody know what Yiddish is? It's kind of German, Hebrew. It's the language my parents talk when they didn't want me to understand it. Yeah. And so Feinberg found the track rather than his father, I guess, and went over and got in touch with John Solomon, who led him to the Lord. And also, of course, Dr. Feinberg's wife was a Jewish believer. And so Dr. Feinberg had a real interest in Jewish evangelism, of course. And so one day I came as president of Chosen People. I'm always concerned about the training of new missionaries. And I, like so many of other Jewish believers, have gone to seminaries or Bible colleges where the Jewish training we got was, you know, we got Bob Soucy let us do a paper on Old Testament eschatology from a Jewish perspective. You know, we got somebody to let us do something that was Jewish. And so every paper I ever did in Bible college or seminary always had a sort of a Jewish twist to it because, you know, I wasn't able to get those courses that I needed for my ministry. And so I put something together and came to my good friend Dennis Dirks, who I knew would give me good and sound advice. And I said, what do you think of this kind of a program? And he said, well, we might be interested in that. Let me think about it. Let me pray about it. And I, of course, was shocked. And here's something that's probably a little new. One of the real hang-ups in starting the program at Talbot was not ATS, was not WASC. The real hang-up was really the New York Board of Regents. And the New York Board of Regents and the Texas Board of Regents, you know, they're pretty independent characters. And so the New York State Board of Regents runs. And you could get middle states, but if you don't have New York State Board of Regents, you're not real. And they could shut you down. And so we had a board member at the time who grew up with a guy who was a lawyer, and he was the only evangelical Christian on the New York State Board of Regents. I think there were about 24 or 27 regents. And he had retired from the Board of Regents, but the person that he mentored was now in charge. And so I went to lunch with him and my friend, and I said, and Greg was there, and I said, so what do you think about us partnering with Talbot? He said, well, you know, it's a good idea, but, you know, New Yorkers really don't like Californians. And I'd say that the chances of this happening are pretty dismal. And I said, but you're willing to help us. Oh, yeah, I'll help you, but I don't think there's much of a chance. I think I'm understating it. And finally, at the end of the conversation, though, he looked at me and he said, but Mitch, if you pray about it and you believe that God wants you to do it with Talbot, then the Lord can do it if he wants. And I said, all right, Ed, I'll pray about it. Prayed about it, and no matter what I did, it's not just because I'm a graduate. It's because Biola and Talbot had the heart. When I asked Dennis eventually, why do you want to do this? He just looked at me and smiled and said, it's our mission. And so, lo and behold, after quite a bit of time, the New York State Board of Regents gave us their approval. A lot of it involved a steak dinner at Smith & Walensky's on a site visit, but I won't speak any further about that. But there are ways to talk New Yorker to New Yorker. And so eventually they approved the school. We've now had our first class of graduates. We had four now, and now we have three more. So that's going to be seven in the MDiv, Messianic Jewish Studies. And we have about 15 or 20 students in the program, which we don't want that many more. We want the best quality people, but we don't want a lot more quantitatively. And we have about five or six coming in the fall. And the Lord just continues to do that. And right over there, you see Mike Brady, who's part human, part angel, and who helps us so much behind the scenes. And Greg Haig, of course, is the dean and site director. And then our dearly departed Dennis Dirks. Dearly, almost departed.
For which this is a memorial service.
Dennis has been just incredible. Just doing so much of the Dennis, just doing all the hard work and doing all the detail and grunt work yourself. It's just been a labor of love, and we'll be forever grateful. And our prayer is that we'll continue to have this great relationship with Talbot. Some of you have come and taught, and you know our students are on campus in the summer. It's been a very happy partnership, and we believe that more Jewish people are going to get saved as we approach Romans 11, 25, and 26 because of what God's doing through this.
We have time for just one more question. Michael, let me put this question to you. Tell us a little bit more about evangelism in Israel. Is it legal to share the gospel? And if so, what types of evangelism, what types of ministry is reaching the Jewish people now?
Well, thank you, very good question. Make it really short and sharp. Evangelism is absolutely legal in Israel, and you can do whatever you want, unfortunately. I mean, not about evangelism, not just everything. We are famous by gay parades and all that stuff. It just became Mecca for, you know, all the liberals from all around the world. And they, like it or not, see us as the part of this liberal movement. I remember a few years ago, like 10 years ago, one of the leaders of the leftist parties spoke a few words on our behalf, and he told publicly that they're not less worthy than community of gays and lesbians, so let's just welcome them, you know, they're minors, and I'm not very happy about that, but on another hand, it gives us opportunity to do whatever we want, and again, legal perspective, absolutely positive, we can do, we can share gospel with everyone but minors, and we cannot do it in exchange of goods, but that's fine. So that's about legal aspect. As with regard to practical, the ways we share gospel, we love it or not, but classic evangelism is not so much popular in Israel. It doesn't work very much. I mean, sharing tracts, standing on the corner of the streets, happens time to time that despite of all that, God brings fruit forth. And even through this sort of evangelism. But I noticed specifically last years, the most effective is one-to-one personal ministry, or all sort of so-called humanitarian ministry. So I don't call it this way. I call it just answering the needs of the people and making them jealous of who we are. So to make people jealous, you have to be transparent in your everyday life. You have to be open to any questions, and you have to show to the people unconditional love. And I believe with all my heart that's not the only way, but that's the best way of sharing gospel with Jewish people. If you add to this all sort of work of Bible popularization and promoting biblical values and New Testament values among different kinds of people in Israel, soldiers, single moms, Holocaust survivors, artists, IDF soldiers again, homeless people, those who are on drugs, being involved, and we see it more and more in political issues, social issues. In other words, becoming not marginal movement, but mainstream movement. It probably will give you some of the picture that how we do evangelism in Israel. And again, in my estimation, very successful on comparison with 23 Jewish believers in the year 48 and having around 25,000 today. Mm. So just pretty big move. Mm. Yep.
God is at work, and we're grateful
Amen.
For that.
Amen.
Thank you so much for sharing just a few glimpses of what's on your heart and what has been part of the focus of your ministries. This week, as you know, we have the conference Israel, the Church, and the Middle East Crisis. One of the purposes for this conference is to draw attention once again of the church, the evangelical church, to the Jewish people and the nation Israel. I don't know if you've noticed, but it is a silent subject in more and more churches these days. We want to try to reverse that a bit and bring back some attention to what God is seeking to do among the people of his choice. And we as Gentiles are so grateful that through those people, through the Jewish people, he has brought the blessings of God to us as well. Thank you for joining us. Let's express our appreciation to these guests.
There are some wonderful books in the back. You've got a bunch of Joel's books, and I think Joel's, those you need to buy. But Joel will be signing them, right, if you'd like. And the Isaiah 53 Explain book is back there as well. Those you can take, and I'd be happy to sign that as well. All you have to do is take it, read it, and then give it to a Jewish friend. It's free. If you want to keep it, it's okay too. So, thanks, Dennis.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.